Well, it could be described, I suppose, as another week of politics versus science in Australia, with yesterday's draft report by Australia's chief scientist Alan Finkel embarrassingly at odds with the government's most recent positions on energy policy. According to the review of the national electricity market, Australia is facing a so-called energy trilemma, and it warns that we won't meet our 2030 carbon pollution reduction target under existing policies. Now, those three pressing issues facing the sector are making sure that there's a stable and reliable electricity market, reducing emissions, and keeping prices down. Now, fortunately, the review also points towards a way ahead if we change the way the grid operates. Michael Liebreich is the founder of Bloomberg New Energy Finance. He's a visitor to our shores. He's a global expert on energy transition, and he can offer some insight into how other countries have managed energy market reform that now seems urgent in Australia. Welcome to Saturday Extra, Michael.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
The review points out that our national electricity market is the longest geographically connected system in the world. And since its design, a lot has changed in terms of energy production. Now, are other countries, in your experience, struggling as much as we are with this challenge?
In terms of the sort of electrical engineering of shifting the grid from these centralized fossil fuel-based systems to bring in all the new technologies, wind, solar, solar on the rooftop, batteries, the answer is pretty much yes. Everybody is struggling with that transition. In terms of some of the politics, it's very unique here.
And so when you look in your role, you must have seen a change in the conversation, the public conversation, I would assume, or is it all happening in back rooms? Because I know that's more the case in the US. I'm just keen to know how you observe how the sort of public conversation shifts or not.
Well, it varies around the world, because what you've got is pretty much most of the advanced economies have been building renewable energy now for a decade at some sort of scale. So we're getting to, you know, 20, 30%, 40% renewable energy in the mix. And that has certain implications. It's just the physics and engineering of the systems. It has implications. So I think every country is struggling with those. How do you change regulation? How do you explain to people what's happening? How do you explain that their bill might go up for some time? It might go down, but things are going to change. What you see, though, is how it manifests in the political debate. You know, in Europe, nobody would say, oh, this is very difficult, it's driven prices up a bit, and therefore climate change doesn't exist. That's something that only happens in certain countries.
No, but as I understand it, for instance, in the US, they don't have this debate, but they're putting absolute fortunes through very clever sort of government underwriting of energy investment and so on behind the scenes to actually make those changes.
Well, so I think you're referring there to the US has been rolling out a lot of renewable energy. In fact, not on a per capita basis, that, you know, more than here. And they have a mechanism in place. They do it through a tax rebate scheme.
Yes.
That has encouraged the rollout of renewable energy for the sort of at the utility scale. But when you say they're putting huge amounts, vast amounts and so on, you know, the costs have come down so substantially that the subsidies are actually on a per kilowatt hour, on a unit basis, are actually coming down very, very rapidly.
But what I'm saying is that big money has gone into this, as I understand from their Department of Energy, but it's not actually been a public debate. We seem to have the public debate, and from what I can see, the big money doesn't get put into it.
I think it has been a big public debate. I mean, if you want to go back to the last election cycle in the US, and there was this solar company called Solyndra, which got some money from a government program and then went bankrupt. And it was a huge public debate. It's just that it doesn't seem right now, now there seems to be much more comfort, even in the US, particularly at the state level, a bit different, obviously, in the federal, the election we've just had. But at the state level, there's a great deal of support for the transition. And that's translating into, you know, there's a little bit of conversation about what are the mechanisms, how do you do it? Do you need to add batteries and storage? And if so, who pays for it and how? What you've not got, I think, even in the US, is the level of polarization that you've got here in Australia.
So who is doing it well, then, in your view?
So as I travel around the world, and I do this, you know, quite a bit, and visit different countries, and been in this year, I've been all over Europe, I've been in Japan, I've been in the US a number of times, China, and so, I don't think there's any country that you could say, look, they've got it, they've nailed it, that's the blueprint, just do exactly the same. So you have, for instance, in Germany, enormous levels of support for renewable energy. It's the energy transition. They clearly are leading in some ways, but on the other hand, it's cost them a lot. Their power bills have gone up a lot. They've not been very efficient about it. And also, they haven't been shutting down their coal-fired power stations. They've chosen to shut down nuclear first. So you couldn't even say Germany has got it all right. There are issues that everybody is grappling with. The question is, do they grapple with it in a sort of productive, rational, science-based way, or do the politics get in the way?
Yes, I mean, it's interesting. In the Finkel report, seven key themes they identify, and what they make it the point, it's an issues paper, it's not recommendations, but the first three are just very interesting. One, technology is transforming the electricity sector, they say. Second, consumers are driving change, which is very interesting. Third, the transition to a low emissions economy is underway. Now, do you think that that's right? I mean, are consumers driving change around the world? Is that what's happening?
Well, first of all, I agree entirely with those three points. I did find the number two point interesting about consumers leading the way. I think that's a little bit glib in the sense that there's an enormous amount of the change that's been driven by behind the scenes, you know, utility managers working with policymakers, working with investors, that's not really been visible to the consumer. The consumer has driven in certain sectors, and by the way, in transportation, when it comes to electric vehicles, consumers are going to be, you know, sorry to pun, but in the driving seat completely. One thing you've got in this country is the solar rooftops are now moving into behind-the-meter batteries. In other words, batteries at the home level. You are the world champions at that. So if consumers leading the way anywhere in the world, it is actually here in Australia.
There was another thing that I noticed in the summary which interested me, and I wondered what if you could help us flesh it out, which was that the market in ancillary services, I think they said, was really poor here but improving elsewhere. Ancillary services for this new energy environment. What are they talking about there, really?
So this is where we run the risk of getting extremely technical. When you run an electrical grid, you've got to make sure that it's not just that you want it's phrased always as, oh, the lights have to stay on. It's not just that. It's actually that the voltage has to remain stable. And that actually is challenging. There's people switching on lights and switching on demand all the time. And of course, when you've got renewable energy, you've got the wind can blow more, or the sun can come out, it can go in. Somebody has to do something to make sure that the voltage remains rock solid throughout.
This is this intermittency thing that they refer
to. The intermittency. Mm. There's another side to it, which is you also can't have catastrophic failures, as you've seen in South Australia.
Sure.
You need to. So one of the problems in South Australia after the system went down is to get it to come back up, you need something called black start. How do you get a complex system started when it's been completely switched off? And there are services. So these ancillary services are about voltage stability. They're about keeping enough capacity ready in case there's a sudden surge of demand or an unexpected failure of a power station, which does happen. Or how do you get the thing started if it ever does go off? Those services are paid for and they need to be delivered, and the market needs to do that.
And I gather, for instance, that France in December 99 saw 3.4 million consumers without electricity after a cyclone. And in the east coast of the US in 2012, there were 8 million consumers without electricity after Hurricane Sandy flooded the coastal regions of eastern United States. So I suppose I again would ask you the question, what can we learn from elsewhere in terms of this obviously very important point?
Every time there's one of these major failures at the grid level, in fact, any major, even in transportation, I mean, there's so much to learn. There's so much richness. There's never a single cause or a single intervention. You look at what happened in South Australia with the blackout. There are probably 3, 4, 5, 6 different places that there could have been changes that would have stopped that from happening. So you learn from all of it. The interesting thing about, in terms of the context of the Finkel report and these new technologies, is renewable energy, distributed energy, could either lead to more instability, more problems, the greater likelihood of a catastrophic blackout and failure, or if they're correctly managed, actually can give a lot of resilience because they're distributed, there's a lot of them, they're out at the edge of the grid, not at all at the center of the grid. And what we're really looking for is a solution that leads to resilience rather than to risk. And I would finish with, you actually also have a what looks like a world champion at that here in Western Australia, which is Horizon, who are providing resilient mini-grids to remote communities. And the knowledge they've got of how to do that is probably among the best in the world. How to use renewable energy to deliver resilience at a remote community level.
So you're saying there are technical solutions to these problems, but do they have to go hand in hand with the right regulatory environment, in your observation?
Absolutely they do, because energy is going to be regulated. There are lots of reasons for that, partly because it's got these very complex systems, partly because you have the less well-off have to be insured supply, so you have an obligation to serve. You've got remote communities that would be very expensive. They wouldn't be able to afford electricity unless there was some sort of a policy framework that required it. And you also need market demand, you know, market rules. So ancillary services, somebody has to say, this is how you make sure that somebody is sitting there with some excess capacity ready to serve if there's a surge in demand. Somebody has to decide those rules. That's the role of the policymaker, of the regulator. You can't step away from that. And if you get it wrong, instead of having cheap, clean, resilient power, you have power that costs more and more, that is not reliable and doesn't meet the Paris commitments on climate and emissions reductions.
Could I ask you then about the business front? I mean, we've heard from the review and from other sources that this ongoing instability in energy policy in Australia is very unattractive. In fact, we've heard that the business people are sort of yearning for some more certainty. Now, you operate in London, which is the capital of finance for a lot of investments. What do you hear and what do you tell clients about investing here, I wonder, Michael, if they're involved in the energy sector?
Well, I think it's more, in a sense, what do the clients tell us? And it's absolutely clear that uncertainty is like, kryptonite for investment. You can't invest in large... it's not like you can pick up a solar farm or a wind farm or even a gas-powered station and move it around. These are long-term infrastructure investments. You need to have policy stability. And the way that manifests then in electricity prices is if you don't get that stability, the only way you'll invest anyway is if you're going to earn a higher return. Where you say, look, it's risky. We don't know what's going to happen to whatever mechanism after 2020. So we're exposed to risk. So now we need higher returns, whether it's the equity provider, whether it's the debt provider. And that actually comes through into the electricity prices, pure and simple. 10 years of policy instability, chopping and changing, political tugs of war, you can see it in your electricity bills. When you see that bill next time, look at it and remember all of the to-ing and fro-ing and all that nonsense about the carbon tax and it was going to do this and it was going to do that. The resulting instability is what has driven up the electricity prices.
But I suppose I could say to you, Michael, maybe it suggests that people like your good selves have not won the arguments. That if we have got this level of instability, there's something missing if others are getting it and we're not.
I'm a humble electricity analyst or energy analyst, energy and transportation analyst. And so, you know, I think that the role of who should be winning political arguments is surely the political economy. It's the other politician. It's not really our role as expert, any of us, whether it's Bloomberg New Energy Finance or any of the other. But, you know, there is pretty much unanimity amongst the energy analysts that, for instance, the current policy set will not result in the achievement of the Paris targets. There is unanimity that the uncertainty will stop investments and drive up electricity prices. So, I mean, maybe I've been wondering whether it takes the form of some kind of grand bargain where the whole of this policy area could be somehow demilitarized, depoliticized in some way to say, look, this is actually too serious. This is now getting to the point where it's about the competitiveness of Australian industry. It's about the security of supply to Australia's homes and hospitals. And we've just got to actually stop some of the nonsense, both sides, everybody, and say, look, let's get some kind of a consensus around the next 15 years so that the money can flow and the system, whether it's this percentage of renewables or whether it's gas as a transition fuel or whatever, but, you know, it has to meet the needs of the trilemma.
All right, Michael, that's on the table. Thank you very much indeed for your time. I appreciate it.
Very good. It's a pleasure.
Michael Liebreich serves on the UN Secretary-General's High-Level Group on Sustainable Energy for All. He's chairman of the advisory board at Bloomberg New Energy Finance. It's a company he founded in 2004 that was acquired by Bloomberg.